On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, there's this kind of joke among directors now that every time you add another good actor, they're like, great, and can you just get one more? And great, and can you give us one more?
Despite a shrinking budget and challenging subject matter, director Tom McCarthy pulled together a stellar ensemble for his new movie, Spotlight. Mark Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, Rachel McAdams, and Liev Schreiber. McCarthy tells us how Spotlight went from non-starter to awards contender, and how the plan for his career as a writer, actor, and director has always been, don't have a plan. But first on the News Banter, Kurt Sutter axes himself, and the Weinsteins may not have happy holidays. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Kim.
So, Kurt Sutter. Kurt Sutter is not a man who's shy. He's been on the show a couple of times, more beeps per minute than any other guest we've ever had. He's an expletive lover. He did something kind of unusual. He is the guy who did Sons of Anarchy, which was a huge success for FX.
The most watched show in the history of FX.
Yes, a big success. Of course, they gave him, you know, the opportunity to do his next show, The Bastard Executioner. People did not connect with The Bastard Executioner, set in the 14th century, dark, violent, not quite motorcycles like Sons of Anarchy. And he took out an ad in our publication, The Hollywood Reporter, and elsewhere, and said, you know, that he was kind of participating in the decision to cancel his show.
Yeah, I mean, the show did not connect. It premiered okay, but 6 weeks in, it had lost half its audience. It was in a downward trajectory. And from what I understand, it was a very difficult shoot. They were shooting in Wales. The weather was not cooperative. A lot of the cast and crew were away from their families for a long time. And after the finale aired, Kurt Sutter basically took it into his own hands and said, I don't want any confusion or I don't want anyone being strung along. This show is done. We're canceling. So in a sense, he canceled his own show.
Although that I'm sure it would have happened, likely to have happened anyway.
Yes, I'm sure it would have happened anyways. But in typical Kurt Sutter fashion, he did it in a dramatic flair with an ad that basically thanked everyone and said, the audience has spoken, and the answer was meh.
The answer was meh. He said, it's fantastic to get a good review, an award, but at the end of the day, the only thing that matters really is numbers. I'm not the guy sitting in my ivory tower spitting shit out and not caring if anyone is watching. So he's got another show in the works, so we don't have to have a fundraiser for Kurt Sutter. But
no, he has an amazing 3-year deal at Fox, and he will do another show. So it's not like we have to take out a collection for him. But it is interesting that one of the highest rated shows in FX's history is followed up by something that is just a dead on arrival show.
That's the way Hollywood works. You know, that's why everybody's crazy in Hollywood, because you just don't know. There's no formula. We may have to have a fundraiser for the Weinstein Company, which seems to be slashing staff and then following that by slashing staff again. Even the principals, Harvey and Bob Weinstein, who are, you know, certainly major figures in this business and have done movies of all kinds, but a lot of awards movies, from The Piano, The English Patient, many, many, many. They're the home of Quentin Tarantino. He's about to have Hateful Eight for the holidays, which they now need very desperately for it to be a hit, it would seem. But even their future, the Weinstein brothers, they just re-upped their deal, but people are just scratching their heads and wondering what is going on with this company, which seems to be kind of dwindling before our eyes.
Yeah, they laid off about 50 people this week. They are not retrenching, but they are being much more cautious. They're usually one of the biggest buyers on the film festival circuit. They have not been as big a buyer lately. They had a deal in place to sell their television division to ITV, which is a big British broadcaster, and that fell apart at the last second. That was a potentially $500 million to $900 million deal. So they are kind of reeling right now. The COO, David Glasser, he quit.
And he's not the only one. Many of the top executives have been out the door. But yes,
yeah,
David Glasser quit.
He quit and then he came back and then very bizarrely announced that he was returning to the company 6 weeks later. So the Weinstein Company has always been a mystery wrapped in an enigma because it's not a public company. Nobody really knows what's going on there. They have spin after spin after spin. So I think ultimately it's going to be whether these movies start coming out and whether they stop buying movies, that will be the sign as to what the financial health of this company is.
But meanwhile, there are, you know, reports that they're slow to pay fees or that some checks are not cashing properly or they're delayed. And that's not brand new, but that's been going on for a while. But yeah, it looks like a company that is deeply challenged and what the future is definitely far from clear. Also, a little bit of a mystery, although certainly not in the category of the Weinstein Company with its many, many troubles, is Lionsgate. This weekend, we see a huge performance from the last of the Hunger Games series, the fourth one. These movies have all performed in the past in the, you know, 700, 800 million worldwide, you know, very successful. Before that, they had Twilight, which when they acquired Summit, which was the original company that made the Twilight movies. And they've had a tremendous run. But now, you know, the franchises are both ended. And it's the question is, where is it going from here?
Yeah, this has been a great run for the Hunger Games franchise, and Lionsgate has really cornered this, you know, YA, female-fronted action franchise. And the question now is, are they in play? What are they going to do to keep up these revenues? They have a great TV division. They produce shows like Orange is the New Black and Nashville, and they had Mad Men as well. But on the film side, they don't have anything in the pipeline right now that is screaming another gigantic franchise. The Divergent movies did not do as well as they had hoped. And now you've got John Malone, who is a big media mogul with Liberty Global and a couple of other companies. He has bought a stake in Lionsgate, and the speculation is whether he's going to continue to try to basically take that company over or convince it to merge with another company, perhaps Starz, which Malone has another interest in, perhaps Discovery, which is another Malone company. But clearly there's something afoot, and I wouldn't be surprised if Lionsgate became a buyer or a seller very soon.
Yeah, I think the view has been that for a long time that Lionsgate has been wanting to sell, but only in the right circumstances, and they fended off a couple of suitors that they really didn't want, you know, strongly rebuffed them. But this thing seems to be more cooperative, and, you know, we are at a point, they've been independent. That's really tough in this world today in Hollywood with the way the business is changing. And maybe this is time for them to become part of something bigger. John Malone hates paying taxes. He's a kind of an interesting, mysterious, eccentric guy, but known to be a brilliant strategist, a lover of a very complicated deal, a hater of paying taxes. The Canada thing might help with that because Lionsgate is, in fact, based there. He could acquire things through Lionsgate and, you know, it would be a Canadian company. But whatever happens, it's clear that something is percolating and John Malone, you know, is making plans.
Yeah, I don't believe Lionsgate will look the same as it does today in, you know, 2-3 years. There will be significant additions, subtractions, perhaps a different merged company or perhaps sold outright.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The new movie Spotlight takes its name from a team of investigative reporters at the Boston Globe. That team won a Pulitzer in 2003 for exposing the child sex abuse scandal in a local archdiocese. The film follows the Spotlight reporters as they do the often unglamorous work to show that crimes were committed and that church officials knew about those crimes and covered them up, allowing more children to be victimized. The Spotlight story is a testament to the power of a great editor, Marty Baron, who in 2001 took the helm at the Globe after stints at the Miami Herald, the Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times. In Boston, Baron found a staff that had some awareness of the sex abuse scandal, but had not conceived of tackling the church in very Catholic Boston. In the film, Liev Schreiber plays Baron.
We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
Tom McCarthy, the director and co-writer of Spotlight, is a true multi-hyphenate. He's an actor who appeared in Meet the Parents and the acclaimed HBO series The Wire. McCarthy's breakthrough as a director came when he made the 2003 film The Station Agent, which he also wrote. He followed that with two more well-received films, The Visitor and Win-Win. When McCarthy undertook Spotlight, he thought it could be good, but he didn't necessarily expect it to be what it is now, a strong awards contender.
I've been doing it just long enough to know you can never plan on anything or count on anything, I think. And with this one, there was just so much work to do right from the get-go that is my favorite part of the process, the work. So I wasn't really looking ahead very often. I always knew it would be compelling just because of the material and the characters involved. But the question was, would it have emotional value? And that's what I couldn't tell until we started screening it for just small audiences in our edit room. And we could sense that it was impacting them in that way.
Yeah. So you, of course, this is not a thought original to me, but you played bad journalist in The Wire, which is a really good show.
Yeah.
If you haven't watched it, watch it, people. And now you're doing this. It's kind of funny, right?
It is funny. And I will say, I mean, I did play a very bad journalist, and I hear about that all the time in my regular life. People love beating me up for that show.
Get mad at you.
They really do not like that character, Scott Templeton, and sometimes they cross the line.
I was confused.
Without a doubt the biggest wanker on that show. It just seems like the right word, even though it's not really an American word.
Yeah.
I will say, though, I learned a lot about journalism on that show.
How not to be one.
But also, I had the good opportunity to spend a fair amount of time with David Simon, and he's just...
Who was the journalist, obviously.
And he's just... I mean, I think that season was very special to him because of his love for newspapers and journalism and paper. And it's tough to be around someone that long and not just completely be affected by him. I mean, he's so passionate for it. And... I think I learned a lot about that, about the sort of blue-collar approach that he sort of embodies to journalism, to just like, there's nothing fancy about it. You just do the hard work.
Do the work, yeah.
And that really stuck with me, I think, as we approached this project and started sitting down with these reporters and interviewing them for the first time 3 years ago.
They're not the most forthcoming people in the world. I met them here in the halls of KCRW, two of them, not the whole team. They're not chatty guys, those two guys, in my brief experience.
Yeah. I think, you know, they're used to being anonymous. They're not used
to
this.
They ask the questions.
Yeah. I mean, look, when I started heading up there, Josh Singer and my co-writer took a train up to Boston. It was the first time we sat with them individually and collectively in different groups and groupings. And it took a while for us to gain their trust. They just were not. I mean, they signed over their life rights in terms of the story, and they were ready to collaborate. But I don't think they were really ready to open up.
Yeah.
And that took maybe a year where we really felt like we were getting beyond the kind of script that they had in their minds, you know, because keep in mind, we sat down with them in 2012, 2013. That was almost 10 years since the investigation. So some of it they had to recall, but they were just, understandably, they were protective. They played it close for a while. They were really nice from the get-go, and they're really smart and interesting people, but I think it took them a while to trust us.
I mean, what was the sort of thing you wanted them to give you?
I think like with anyone, with any writer of any sort, you're trying to get below the surface, right? There was a lot of information. There was no source material. Obviously,
our movie
focuses on the investigation, right?
Right?
And there was no book. So we had to kind of reconstruct the investigation just by talking to them and everyone else we could. But again, 10 years ago, so everyone remembers it slightly differently. So there's a lot of triangulation and going back and back and back again. And they're busy working. They were doing their job. Marty was at the Washington Post.
Marty Baron.
Yeah, Marty Baron was at the Washington
I knew
Post.
Marty Baron when he was at the LA Times long ago. He was a business editor.
Right, right.
You captured him quite well. I mean, he's quite an unusual sort of person. Very, certainly not, I wouldn't say unfriendly, but not like warm and cuddly.
Yeah.
Very, very smart, but kind of different.
Yeah. Someone at the Boston Globe described his approach as the joyless pursuit of excellence.
And it's kind of perfect,
it seemed
probably,
to be the label that we went with from Marty, everyone we talked to. And I know him now quite well, having spent a good deal of time, and he's actually a lovely and warm person at this point. But, you know, when we showed him the first cut of the movie, he brought a friend of his who was, I think, an AP reporter. And after the screening, the gentleman he brought said, well, I have to say, I think you portrayed Marty a bit coldly, actually. He's a little more warm than that. And Marty looked at him and said, I wasn't then.
I wasn't then.
Yeah.
Now he's editor of the Washington Post. He's warmed up a little, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So you have had a very, you've had a sort of a zigging and zagging career. And I don't know how much of it was planned. You obviously I've done everything.
None of it was planned, I can tell you now. I'm not a very good planner.
So the acting came first, right?
Yeah, I went, you know, I got serious about acting probably when I was at the Yale School of Drama, and I graduated as an actor and started doing theater regionally and then got into television and then some film, and then I did my first play on Broadway, and then after that, I directed The Station Agent, and the Station Agent sort of redefined my career as a writer and director. And then since that time, I have been zigging and zagging, as you say, because I'm not great at planning.
How did you come to do Station Agent from being on? You know, it's not often a transition that people make in my novel, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, even before Yale, I was writing quite a bit. I started doing improvisational comedy and at Boston College, where I was an undergraduate, and then out in Minneapolis with some friends. And over time, writing and acting seemed all part of the same thing for me, storytelling. So when I was doing theater, I just started writing. And I think in my mid-20s is when I really fell in love with movies, you know, and sort of late compared to some directors, probably most directors. But it's really, I really started to appreciate cinema and really kind of dig in. And at some point, I just decided I would take a crack at it and write my first script. And that turned out to be The Station Agent.
How did you manage to make that into a thing? You know how many people write a first script and sits there for the rest of time?
Yeah, exactly. It took a while. You know, I wasn't in a rush. I knew I wanted to direct it when I was finished writing the script. And it took a long time because you can imagine that's not the easiest pitch in the world.
And even when this guy.
Yeah, at that time, no one knew Peter Dinklage was going to become world famous, and Bobby Cannavale and Patty Clarkson. So I had those guys on, and we had the script for a long time.
Where did you meet Peter Dinklage?
Met Peter right when I was at Yale. I came down and I directed a play off Broadway that I had written with another guy, and we were looking for someone to play Tom Thumb. It was a story of P.T. Barnum, and someone said, "You got to go see Dink. He's doing a play." And I went and saw him in the play, and he was terrific, and I cast him in this play, and we became fast friends.
You had already conceived Station Agent and then conveniently met someone who was the perfect person to or was the role not even?
I was about halfway through the script, and I literally ran into him on the streets of New York, and he was coming home from a temp job. He was temping at that point to make money, and we were just chatting, and he walked away, and I just had this moment of like, he would be the best character for this film if I could pull it off. And it was really as simple as that.
So you reshaped the script.
Yeah, it didn't take much. He was an outsider. He was a loner. He arrived in a small town and lived in a train depot. So I just wrote him like Pete.
It sounds like inspiration.
I guess it was a moment of that, yeah.
And did you have to do with putting him... I know you had a sort of a brief relationship with Game of Thrones.
Yeah, no, I directed the pilot, which then I left to go direct Win-Win, and they reshot a lot of the pilot and recast a lot of it. Some actors fell out, some they recast, and I was not allowed to do that. So went immediately into production after leaving. So that was it. I had a good time. It's a really cool show. That was sort of my stint with that show.
Did you put him in it?
They were talking to him when I came on, and I think me being on probably helped a little bit, but they were already considering him. David and Dan had already reached out to him.
So I think I read an interview with you that said, you know, you concluded that TV is really not a director's medium, and that maybe that has to do with why your interest was not particularly in sticking around on Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some wonderful directors who do TV, I think, obviously, and it's certainly changed a lot, that show included, but there's been a lot of great TV shows over the last 10 years. But it is more of a showrunner's medium, I think, right? The writers and the showrunners, and it seems like directors kind of come in and out. There's very few shows where it's the same director all the way through. So it's tough to, I think, have a singular vision as a director when you don't have that control. In film, you do. It's just a different hierarchy, but... you know, I'd go back and direct in TV again if it was right. It just had to be right, and you'd have to have the right amount of control and involvement, I think. But everyone's different.
You'd have to be a showrunner.
Maybe, but I just don't know if I would want to do that. It seems like a long,
because you marry the thing and for...
Yeah, I kind of like moving on to different projects and falling into different worlds.
Coming up after a short break, McCarthy tells us about making Spotlight while getting the worst reviews of his career for another project. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Tom McCarthy, who directed and co-wrote the new movie Spotlight, about the real-life investigative team of reporters who uncovered the infamous child sex abuse scandal in the Boston Archdiocese. Mark Ruffalo plays journalist Michael Resendiz, who turns for guidance to lawyer Mitchell Garabedian. Played by Stanley Tucci, he represents some of the victims and knows all about the cover-up.
And so I could just walk into that courthouse right now and get those documents?
No, you cannot, because the documents are not there.
But you just said they're public.
I know I did, but this is Boston, and the church does not want them to be found. So, they are not there.
When a group of producers first sought out McCarthy to direct Spotlight, he was intrigued, but his initial answer was no.
They approached me once, and I think I was editing Win-Win or something, and or shooting, and I didn't have the time. I couldn't. It was just so much. It was a really interesting story, but it was just overwhelming how big it was. And I said, you got to go get someone who can get to work now for you. And
there was no script.
There was no script. There was just the life rights. And
I mean, do you know how it came up to be a light bulb in their minds if there was no book?
I think they had talked to someone at the Columbia Journalism School who had sort of taken them through a thumbnail of the reporting and why it was seen as such a seminal investigation. And I mean, look, even when they finally sat down, they approached me a year later and sat down with me again and said, just think about it again. And they flew to New York and we sat in a cafe.
Had they been knocking on doors and told, you know,
I think so.
And
I think they had actually tried with another writer and it wasn't successful. And they came, they just felt like I was the right person. I don't know why. I'm very thankful they did.
You really don't know why?
I mean, I'd have to let them speak to that. I think they just like my movies and they knew I was raised Catholic. They knew I went to school in Boston and they felt like there was a lot of connection there.
So they come to you and you're busy and then you sort of circle back and what grabs you?
Just that opening pitch, that thumbnail of Marty arriving in day one going after the Catholic Church. I mean, his first day, his first 10:30, he sets his sights on the Catholic Church, arguably the most powerful and iconic institution in Boston at the time. And then as I started to dig in a little bit, I just realized how rich and textured the material was.
So did you have legal advice? Like these are the people who must sign off and these people you can just portray?
Well, we knew we had the life rights to the reporters. And then a lot of the other people were public figures, right? They'd already been on the record. I mean, we're constantly checking in with our lawyers. And sometimes we're advised, don't talk to this person or we can't use this name. And there was a healthy back and forth through the entire process.
And that must have been a part of financing it because they don't work for free.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did that work, the financing?
That's a good question. I mean, look, to make movies like this anymore, it's really difficult, even when you have a lot of good partners involved, and we did. Early on, it was the four producers, and then shortly thereafter, Jonathan King and Participant Media came on board, and I made another movie with them, The Visitor, and they're very good partners. And so we had this, and then Open Road joined us, who was distributing the movie. So we had all these wonderful partners, but it was still tricky just to put it together, the math of it. You know,
a little surprised because it feels like of the ones you named, several of them could write a check and that would be it.
Yeah, but you know, it's all about risk, right? And it's a very, very risky model anyway, and you know, especially now. So we were right down to the wire on this one. There were more than a few weekends where I thought, I don't know if we're going to get this movie made.
Did you feel that you had to make a compromise because of the money?
Never. No. I was definitely getting worried about the budget because it kept shrinking, but I had an excellent line producer, Michael.
It kept shrinking?
Yeah, of course. We started a great number, and then it kept coming down every round. That's how it happens. They keep shaving until you think, at some point, I've got to walk away because I can't make them. I've got to do the material justice. But I had a wonderful line producer, Michael Biederman, also the executive producer on the movie, who just kept coming up with new and inventive ways of putting a budget together that made sense, that would in no way sacrifice the vision of the film or my vision of the film. And that included going up to Toronto and rebuilding the Boston Globe newsroom, which was a massive undertaking that my production designer, Steve Carter, did an amazing job.
I heard it was replicated to the point where it was actually spooky.
It was really great. And he built both the newsroom and the spotlight room. Now, we shot all our exteriors in Boston. We also shot in the Boston Globe inside and outside. And so we would connect the real Globe to our set. But you know, the logic, which was right, was, hey, we're going to be inside anyway. Who cares if we're in Brockton, Mass, or in Toronto? So we were kind of shuttling back and forth between the two cities for the entire production, which, believe it or not, made financial sense.
And where is the cast? I mean, you have an amazing cast.
Yeah.
Did you have the cast? And still the money was constantly a struggle?
Even as we were putting the cast in place. You know, there's this kind of joke among directors now that every time you add another good actor, they're like, great, and can you just get one more? And great, and can you give us one more? And But look, we were very lucky with this movie. I felt like this is a movie I was going to be able to cast up. I was going to be able to get a really great cast. The material was interesting. Mark Ruffalo signed on almost immediately. He was the first one we went on to. And from there on, we just had momentum. A lot of the other actors are guys I've come up with and was able just to send a script to Liev Schreiber and John Slattery and Stanley Tucci and people I've known for a long time but haven't had the opportunity to work with. So it really happened pretty quickly. And then Michael Keaton and Rachel McAdams, they're two actors I knew of, obviously, but hadn't worked with or didn't really know. And that just, we set up a meeting and that was that.
And no one said, "Whoa, Michael Keaton and Liev Schreiber, here's another $5 million for you."
It doesn't quite work like that. They were excited, though, with everyone we cast. And you know, Rachel was one of the last, and everyone was very excited when she signed on, obviously. You know, and I think what's more exciting is to see their performances now. I've never seen Rachel do anything quite like this, and I think she's just wonderful in the movie.
Yes, she is. Meanwhile, while you're doing all of these things, mm-hmm. the station agent, this, that, you're acting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you just kind of sustaining yourself by performing and, you know, making money so you can do Spotlight? Or are you just like you want one from column A and one from column B all the time and therefore you shuttle back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, you said earlier, there's no plan. You're right, there has been no plan. I've worked with the same agent since I was out of Yale, Rhonda Price. And our sort of approach has always been, what's interesting? What haven't we done? What's interesting? And it's really that simple because I find you're more excited about the project if you approach it that way. Mapping out never seems to work in this industry.
No, I couldn't do it either.
Yeah, so, you know, I feel very fortunate I've been able to kind of pursue what I want and when I want. I will say it's been more difficult to act because of kind of stringing the movies together. And so what else I've been doing is I do a lot of rewrites for studios and write some original things for studios, which helps because I have
this
a little bit
like
more flexibility.
This is like uncredited writing.
Sometimes credited. Mm-hmm. You know, like Million Dollar Arm was a film I wrote for Disney that Craig Gillespie directed, which I thought was really fun. I love that work. I love collaborating with different people and trying to make projects better. And you know, it's just exciting.
You know, you've had a very charmed career in a lot of ways, especially with the films you directed, but there is the one that didn't work.
Yeah.
And I know I've read that you really like it, and this is a Cobbler, obviously. I'm
yeah,
talking about
the Cobbler,
Adam
yeah,
Sandler.
Came out early in the year and got beat up critically. No, I mean, this is what we do. Just like with Spotlight, we took a lot of chances. It seems to be paying off, and did the same thing with the Cobbler, maybe not as successfully for some people, but my job is to tell the stories, to learn, do the best I can, and move on. And you're right, it was the first film that I didn't have the sort of critical success and support that I've been used to. And it was a challenging and interesting experience and probably made me better. It certainly made Spotlight better.
Did you expect it? Did you have an uh-oh feeling when you were shooting it or when it was screening? Or did you just sort of go, holy crap, what? I thought this was great.
I never think anything's great. I think some good. I was a little surprised. I mean, it does seem that there was like a real, people got very angry at me for making that movie, but I don't know why. I think it's a really fun and charming film. But look, that's the business, right? It's a very public profession.
This is the life you have chosen.
Yeah, you're out there, you're on the mound, and if, you know, you give up a run, you give up a run. So all I can do is kind of swallow it, and it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt, right? Especially now where some people are just so aggressively critical.
Yeah.
You just kind of get back to work. I was in pre-production for Spotlight when that movie broke, so I just kind of kept working.
I would imagine that would really rattle the hell out of you. You're in pre-production and this other thing doesn't work and you suddenly, I would probably think, do I know what I'm doing? I don't know if I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I ask that question all the time anyways. I was back there again. But, you know, really what it does is just inspire, it just kind of motivated me just to kind of get back to work. Look, it was hard, of course, but I feel very lucky to do what I do, quite honestly,
right,
to make a good living doing it. So there's bigger problems.
Tom McCarthy is the director and co-writer of Spotlight. Thank you so much for coming in.
And a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.